The next piece of the morning would be probably neither of these two venerable, honourable gentlemen need any introduction. But Ajahn Sumedho has kindly agreed to introduce Jack and say a few words to by way of lead-in. And the fellow in the black shirt is Jack Kornfield, and famous upstager of Paul Breiter. And he's also the exhibition of pictures that has been put together very generously comes from the archives of an extraordinarily monk who protects his collection of pictures very, very carefully, and actually Ajahn Manindo offered them for us to use. And amongst the archive of pictures, one that didn't get prepared for the display is the one that Jack's just put up on the shrine, which is colloquially known as the Vince Lombardi picture of Ajahn Chah. So those of you can take a closer look at it later on to find out why.
So this is a unique experience for me, getting to introduce somebody who doesn't really need an introduction. It's like Jack could introduce me, saying he doesn't really need an introduction. But anyway, this is a unique occasion here with so many of us coming together who at one point, one place, at this weekend here, when we reflect on our teacher Ajahn Chah. And I met Jack in 1967, I think, in Thailand, and he was in the Peace Corps in a province known as Sukhumvit, which was in the northeastern part of Thailand, but quite a distance from Ubon, and where Ajahn Chah lived. And I asked Ajahn Chah for a kind of opportunity to go off. I always wanted to be a hermit, and the life at Wat Pa Pong was always so, so many demands of having to chant and attend pujas and people coming and having to live with so many other monks that finally, after much delay, Lung Po Chau finally allowed me to go, because I was still very young, very new monk. And I went up to this place, this mountain in Sukhumvit province called Phupek. And it was about the highest peak in that range, Phupan range in northeast Thailand. And it was very difficult to get to. And we had to kind of walk in and climb up in our terms, in American terms, it wouldn't be a mountain, but in Thai terms, it is. Anyway, it seemed really very high mountain when you have to climb up and down it every day. And this was, it had an old ruined or unfinished Khmer temple on top. And I really had to kind of idealize this place. I think it wouldn't be wonderful to be alone and practice. And there were two other Thai monks there with me. And during that time, I was, so many things happened to me, but I hadn't met any Westerners for so long. And then suddenly, one day, Jack Kornfield turns up, and an American, and I was quite surprised and overwhelmed that he seemed so interested in the Buddhism and meditation, and asked so many questions. We had quite a long conversation. And then he came up one more time to see me before I left. I was there 6 months, nearly died. Every horrible thing that could happen to you happened to me on that time. I got sick, and I was obsessed with it because I was alone with two other monks. It seemed like all the aversion of my life would kind of fix on this one monk. So during the 6 months when I was seeking peace and tranquility, I became obsessed with hatred and aversion. It was so when my robes wore out and I got this thing very I don't know what kind of illness it was, but the villagers had to carry me down the mountain. And then I was in this little hovel down by a reservoir and unable to eat, and the food was very coarse, and under this tin roof in the hot season, these little flies flying in and out, filling into my mouth and ears and nose, and I thought life couldn't get any worse than this. And I'd hear planes flying overhead, and one of my best friends in the Peace Corps was teaching up in Vientiane in Laos and making lots of money and had a nice apartment, and I kept thinking I could be doing that, and here I am, you know, dying in the jungle and you know, just feeling sorry for myself and nobody to console me even. So eventually they villagers became desperate, and they brought in a doctor on a horse because there were no roads to this place, and they filled me full of antibiotics. But then suddenly I started just seeing what I was doing, and I stopped complaining and feeling sorry for myself. I determined not to do that, and I started just doing anapanasati, I started sitting up before I was too weak, and sitting up and just doing, concentrating on my breath, and I stopped all the negativity. And within a week, I was feeling quite healthy, and went back up to live on top of this mountain. But anyway, that was a very. When I went back to Wapapong, Lungpa Cha said, how was your hermit experience? And I told him it was absolutely horrible, and he thought that was hilarious. And I came back in rags. Your robe was just tatters, and you couldn't even sew it. The cloth was so weak, and couldn't even patch it anymore. And he found that very funny, you know. He kept telling everybody, look at Tomato, and but I did feel a joy at being back there, and really, really appreciated what Lungpa Cha offered. And then, Jack was still in the Peace Corps then, but he had decided that when his contract was ended, he would ordain. So eventually he joined me at Wat Pa Pong, so we spent that rains retreat together with Lungpa Cha. And so ever since then, we've had this strong connection, and he went back to the States and set up these, I remember meeting him in 76 in Barre, Massachusetts, when they just acquired the IMS retreat center there. And then through the years, we've managed to keep in touch. And even though in our younger days we could be quite critical of each other, I think now that we're older and wiser, we just appreciate each other very, very much. So now I'll let Jack do the talking.
At least that's so for him, huh? thank you. I feel it's really kind of amazing to walk in here and also to see so many old and very dear friends from over the years. Paul Breiter and Pabakro and Ajahn Pasano and all these very many wonderful friends. And Ajahn Sumedho has really been so important in my life because he told me about Ajahn Chah and the monastery, and then I started to go there and visit and try to find out what I needed to do to learn to become a monk. And but there was something else about Ajahn Sumedho for me, even from early on, and that is that he had a particular way of listening to Ajahn Chah and understanding him that he could then bring alive to the rest of us. Because I think actually a lot of the people who are on this stage who went to Wat Pa Phong and to be with Ajahn Chah were really very deeply influenced by the presence of Ajahn Sumedho. And it's a little bit like you don't understand jazz and somebody puts on John Coltrane or Miles Davis for the first time and you go, what is this? And they say, no, listen to what he's doing. And all of a sudden your jaw drops open and you're just stunned by the music that you hadn't known about and hadn't been able to hear. There is some way in which Ajahn Sumedho got intuitively or knew it resonated in him the teachings of Lumpa Cha, even if he couldn't do them so well in the beginning, none of us could really, but there's some way in which he got them, and then he would say, did you hear what he just said, or could you? And it was as if he became the reflection or the translator, the conduit to which then that deeper connection with Lumpa Cha also opened up for a lot of us. So it's really hard to express how much gratitude I have and affection for him. And then I walk in here and I think about Ajahn Chah and look at this place and I say, this is really strange. I mean, I can imagine him walking in here and say, boy, you Americans are so weird. You brought the forest inside, you know? Couldn't you just go out into the forest? Because when he first came to the USA, and he came with Joseph Pabacaro and came, I guess it was 1979, to IMS, to the center in Barrie. We picked him up at the airport and drove him along the Charles River in Boston and pointed out this is MIT and this is Harvard. And he wasn't all that interested in that. Buddhadasa wanted to come and talk at Harvard. He never did it, but he always said, I want to go to Harvard and straighten those people out, but never happened. But Ajahn Chah was, oh, you know, ho-hum, okay, this is the universities, whatever. But then we got out on the main interstate, on the thruway, driving outside of Boston. And once you leave the city itself, as you know, those of you who've been in New England, you start to get to the countryside. There's a lot of trees there. It's just filled with a lot of forests, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine. And so we're driving along, not very far from Boston, and he says, stop the car, stop the car. He said, what is this? And he's looking at all these forests, pull over off this freeway, and then he hopped a fence, and he goes in the forest, he's kind of smelling the air, looking at the trees, and he says, what kind of animals live here? Are there bears, you know, are there lions or tigers, you know, what lives in these forests? And he said, how far do these forests go? We said, oh, they go for, you know, 500 or 1,000 miles up through Canada. He said, wow, what great forests, you know. So he said, so what are you doing with the forest inside? Why don't you go out to the forest? And he would probably look around and he'd say, oh, people interested in Buddhism in America. You're kind of old, aren't you? Maybe you should stand up. You've been sitting a long time. Or maybe you should, why don't you stand up? Or you've been sitting for a while. You can stand up. Go ahead. It's all right, you old people. Go ahead. Or those who aren't old, you'll be getting old. I'm serious. Take a little stretch. You've been sitting. The old people need the Dhamma too, you know. And the ones who aren't so old, it will happen. You just wait. It's a little bit hard to come in the middle of something like this because I'm told that it was very wonderful yesterday and stories and celebration and teachings and so forth. In a way, it's nice to come in and be able to blend with what's happened and to be respectful of what people have already done and not just kind of start over. So I'm sorry that I missed yesterday. And I'll say some things and they may or may not be repetitions. When you went into Wat Bapong, as people have talked about this beautiful forest with the great trees and the ghosts, and it had been a place where there were ghosts, that's why no one lived there. He said, oh, a perfect place for the monastery, and cobras and so forth. And I remember the first time that I came as a monk, I had visited Ajahn Chah as a lay person prior to that, but when I finally ordained and was able to come as a monk, he looked at me, and the first thing he said to me when I came beside, oh, you know, you come, or something like that, he said, well, I hope you're not afraid of suffering. And I thought that was a kind of strange thing. You know, I was coming to get peaceful and be a monk and learn about it. And he said, I hope, well, here you are, I hope you're not afraid of suffering. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, there's two kinds of suffering. He said, there's the suffering that you run away from, you know. And he said, and then he smiled and he said, and it follows you, doesn't it? And then he said, and then there's the suffering that you're willing to turn around and face. He said, and that's the place where you can find the end of suffering. So if you're not afraid, Mike Luatuk, then you can come in the monastery. Then you can come and suffer with the rest of us, you know. Because his interest was really in freedom, more than anything else. It was in communicating this joy and freedom that he experienced so that you would realize that it was possible for you, for us, for each of us as a human being to be free. And you'd come in and there were these little signs. I see that sign on the tree. I didn't get a chance to read it, but it's like little Burma Shave signs when you'd come in, for those, all of us old ones who remember Burma Shave, you know. And they'd say things like, you there, be quiet, we're trying to meditate, you know, or life is short, what are you going to do with it? Isn't it about time you started to awaken, or do you want to sleep forever, or something like that, little kind of. And the quality of the monastery was one of great dignity, in a very natural and organic way. I guess I'll talk about the qualities of his teaching, which I have in the past, in this way. And there were a number of qualities. The first was this quality of dignity and the surrender that was asked in it. And the forest paths were swept beautifully, and there was some sense when you entered that it was really a sanctuary, a sacred place. Not because of great big fancy buildings and temples and cathedrals, but by the way that things were cared for, like a Zen monastery would be. And a bit of a living library, if you will, because I remember I had friends who were also working in Laos and in the areas of Thailand where there was a lot of fighting, and in Vietnam, and they came to visit us in the monastery. Ajahn Sumedho was there as well. And they were very critical. Well, like, what are you doing sitting here when there's a war going on? And at night you could see it, the planes would fly overhead, the bombers would be going over the monastery, and you could see the flashes of light. We were close enough to the border of Laos, or, you know, we weren't that far really from Cambodia either, and you could see and know that the war was going on. And they'd say, here you are sitting on your asses, basically, when something needs to be done. And they were, as I had served on medical teams in that part of Thailand in the Mekong River Valley, and they were right in the middle of the war area doing work with the Quakers and things like that. But they came because they were exhausted and burnt out and suffering a lot. And at first they complained a lot. But by the time this group left, they were there for a week or 10 days, they had realized that Wat Bapong was an ocean or an island, really, of sanity in a sea of madness around, which if anybody's been to a place, lived through a war, people go really crazy, and they tear down their own temples and sell them to get money, and they do horrible things. And it's very frightening. Even ordinary people do things they would never imagine they might get caught in doing. And here was a place where you could lose your valuables and someone just pick it up and save it for you, and where people treated one another with discipline and respect, and where virtue was the way that human beings acted. And it's as if no matter what was happening in the world around, because wars will come and go as birth and death comes and goes, this was a place that was timeless, that said there is a reality, there is a truth, independent of all the conditions that we find ourselves caught in the world. And so that quality of dignity was there, but with it was the surrender. You know, you'd walk. And if you were a young monk, you were expected to walk pretty far for your alms food. You'd walk 5 or 10 miles each way, you know, to get your bowl of food, or you'd sit for hours in the at night on the stone floor. And I remember when I first came, because I'm kind of stiff and not terribly flexible, and I wasn't even then, and we get these little tiny square sitting cloths to sit on the floor, and it's a stone floor. There's no, you know, zafus and chairs and all this kind of stuff. And it was really painful to sit and meditate. My knees were up about like that. And so we'd go in for evening chanting. You'd chant for a long time and you'd sit. And it would gradually get dark. We'd chant. And then as it got dark, I'd see everybody close their eyes, and I was so uncomfortable. I'd go in a little early and I'd sit next to this big stone pillar so that as soon as their eyes were closed, I could kind of lean on it, because it was so painful, you know. And after I'd been there a couple of weeks, Ajahn Chah would give these Dharma talks, and it was the night for the Dharma talk. We'd all chanted, and then we'd been sitting, and then he came in, joined us for the sitting for a while, and started to talk about whatever he was talking about. And he said, to really practice means to become independent of the conditions that change in life, to not need to, and then he turned to me, to not need to lean on things. And there was care with everything, the way you would sweep the path, the way you'd make a bamboo broom and keep the paths of the forest clean, and the way the building was done, and the way you learned to bow to things, and as he said at one point, everything that you do in your life at this monastery is a chance to awaken. It's a chance to practice, to be free. It's all the Dharma. When you do your chores, be mindful. If you're emptying the spittoons and the, you know, garbage, or cleaning the toilet, don't feel like you're doing it as a favor for someone else. There's Dharma in emptying spittoons and cleaning the toilet. That's the place to practice. Don't feel that you're practicing only when you're sitting still, cross-legged. Some of you complain there isn't enough time to meditate. Is there enough time to breathe? This is your meditation, mindfulness, naturalness, and whatever you do. So somehow he trusted the sincerity of your heart, and it was difficult, and the food was not that good, and it was cold. I remember being up at Tham Sang Phet when we were working on the road to build this road up to this cave temple monastery where Ajahn Sumedho lived for a long time. And I was living in one of these little caves just on the ground. And it got so cold, it was winter, and I felt like it must be like 38 or 40 degrees or something, not quite freezing, and a strong wind, and we were walking down the mountain and went to this kind of remote village to get our rice and stuff for food. I was following in the last in line as the new monk with Ajahn Chah. And I had my towel under my robes because I was shivering the whole way. It was all the clothes I had in these cotton robes. And we got to the village and Ajahn Chah turned to me and said, "Cold?" You know, I mean, I was freezing. I said, "Cold? Yeah, it's cold." And he laughed. He said, "Well, this is as cold as it gets," he said, "so you've done it." You know, this is, and he was there with you, whether you were out sweeping the paths or whether you were suffering in the cold or whether you were sitting on the stone all night. He just sat with you and he watched. He just kind of was amused by, there you are. And you could either struggle and suffer, or there would come those moments where you would stop and you'd say, "Well, I guess this is where we are." And he'd look over and he'd smile as if, "Oh, you finally got it. You had a moment where you understand." So simple. He trusted the sincerity of the people who came, So he didn't try to make it any easier for anybody. He just allowed the natural conditions of the monastery to be the teachers for us. You know, and whether we sat up all night long, which we would do, or, you know, when you get sick, I also got quite sick a couple points, and, you know, he came, at one point I was really sick, and he said, well, this, what a great place to practice. He said, I mean, you are going to die, you know, so you might as well, you'll be sick again. This isn't like the only time. You might as well learn. This is a great place. It wasn't like, oh, I hope you get well so you can sit up and meditate, you know, or something like that. This is your place to practice. When it was hard, he would tease you, you know, how are you doing? Are you angry? Are you upset? And then you look and say, well, whose fault is that? So there was a quality of dignity, and the surrender that was asked was to be present for the way things are. He also taught in this, in his role as the elder, with a tremendous honesty. And of course, part of what makes him as funny as he was, because he had this great sense of humor that you can hear coming out, part of what makes things funny is when somebody tells the truth, you know, or says the things that you're not supposed to say, but everybody's thinking anyway, right? There was a kind of compassion in this honesty. Because he would do it with such a light heart, you know, about himself, about others. Whatever was difficult, he said. One day there was this kind of rich layperson who came, and as Ajahn Chah's fame began to spread, initially he was not only not famous, but he was a bit of a pariah. And in fact, the local monasteries, I don't know if this was talked about, but they wouldn't let him ordain monks, wouldn't allow him to do that, and he was really looked down on and so forth. But as his fame began to spread a little bit, this very wealthy person came who had just retired and owned some huge factories or something like that in Thailand and said, I don't know what to do with my money. You know, should I come and give it to this monastery and build you a big temple, or should I build hospitals with it, or, you know, give it to the schools? And I mean, as he was talking, he was so full of himself. You know, what should I do? You're the great Ajahn. You tell me what I should do with my money. And Ajahn Chah listened to him. He looked and he said, you know, when you came to the monastery, you crossed that bridge over the River Moon, this big high bridge on the road here. You should take all your money and just dump it off the bridge into the river. So that's what you should do with your money. You know, the the woman who was in England, I heard this story, I don't know if it was told, who had part of the British Buddhist Society, you know, kind of proper old English Buddhist, who was asking him all these questions about Buddhist psychology and the Abhidhamma, on and on and on, you know, the great master. And finally, at least as the story was told, he finally looked at her and he said, you know, madam, you are like a woman who keeps chickens and goes around picking up the chicken shit instead of the eggs. This is very proper. You are missing the point of the Dhamma. But he was equally honest about himself. You know, he said, when I wandered in the forest, he would talk about it, went on Tudong and so forth, I had my own problems. I had so much suffering and body pain and so many doubts. He said, I would sit in the forest. He would talk about this time where he was sitting there and it was raining and out of the rainy season and my robes were all wet and everything I had was wet and I was sitting and weeping. You know, and I couldn't tell whether it was my tears or it was the rain. I would cry. But he had a quality of daring to him. He just did it, whatever it was. He said, if you haven't really wept deeply, you haven't begun to meditate. So meditation is really to sit and open to what is so in us. He said, I had malaria. I was so sick. I was, you know, I was 30 years old and I look 60 years old. I look like an old man. But you have to have a kind of endurance to practice honorably, the endurance of being willing to be with the world as it is. I remember I went back to ordain and live in Wat Bo Phong as a monk in 1982. 10 years after I had first left, I went back to spend some months there. And Ajahn Chah had been sick prior to that time, and then he got a bit well. It was sort of that interim period where he was well again. And he'd come to visit America and seen the center in Massachusetts and knew that I was teaching and so forth. So that, of course, gave him opportunity for a lot of hard times to give me about all that. But anyway, we were wandering in the monastery, and then this group of lay people came up, and it was a couple of grandparents and a mother and father, and then some other friends, and the woman, who was kind of probably in her like late 30s or 40, had cancer, and she'd come for a blessing. So we sat down. And they brought this whole bowl to do, make holy water and sprinkle it and do this whole kind of healing thing. And Ajahn Chah sat down on a log there and did this whole blessing thing and, you know, wished her well and so forth with her cancer because she had children, and clearly he wanted her to be able to raise her children, to live. It was a very kind of poignant moment because you could tell she was quite ill. And then they bowed and they thanked the Ajahn and they went away. And then he elbowed me because I was sitting next to him. He said, "Did I heal her? Do you think I healed her?" He said, "I'm the teacher, right? You're a teacher. You know, do you heal them?" Right? I said, "I don't know." And he said, "This is how it is." He said, "If she gets better, then everybody's going to go around and say, 'Oh, the great Ajahn healed her. He's such a great, mysterious, wonderful, you know, master. Everybody has to come. He's so great.'" He said, "And if she dies, no one will remember that she came here, will they? Did I heal her? Come on, you tell me." You know, he was so willing to just look at things the way they are and asked everybody else to do the same. So he was very honest about the people around him. You'd come to his little cottage, and there were a number of Westerners by the time I had left. You know, and I remember we visited in 1976 with Joseph Goldstein and Ram Dass and Mark Epstein, and a group of us came to Wat Pah Phong to visit. Ajahn Sumedho and others were there. And we all sat down. Ram Dass had been at that point in Bali surfing before that, and he was real tanned and kind of, he was in his late 40s and kind of really trying to keep himself well and looking good, you know. And we're about 15 years younger than Ram Dass, so the rest of us, Joseph and myself and others, we were maybe like 32, 31, 32, 29 or something. So we all come in and we all bow, sit under the cottage, and Ajahn Chah looks around and he says, "Ah, look at this." You know, and I introduce him to the people. I said, "We've come to see you, and, you know, I've come back and bring some friends who are interested in Dharma." He looks a little bit, he says, "Yeah, who's the old man you brought with you?" You know, and it was really like, you know, at times it was like the seven dwarfs. He'd sit under his cottage and he'd introduce, people would come to visit the Thais, and he'd introduce his Western monks. Or his own, he said, "This one likes to sleep a lot. It's like sleepy and dopey. This is my sleeping monk. And this is the monk that likes to doubt all the time. It's amazing how many doubts he'll come up with. And he likes to sit all the time in his cottage. I don't know, I think he's afraid to relate or something like that, right?" When he came to IMS to Barry, and we were having this retreat, which he helped to lead and teach and so forth, and all these people were out doing walking meditation. He was very, he was actually, I felt, very respectful of the sincerity of the people's practice. He said, "These people practice a lot more sincerely than most of my monks in Thailand. Or, you know, I wish I could get people." Of course, he said it wouldn't hurt for them to lighten up a little bit either. But we were outside and wandering as people were doing their walking meditation back and forth. And he looked this way. He said, "It's really like a big hospital, isn't it? You know?" And then he started walking up to people as they were doing their walking meditation. He said, "I hope you get well soon. You know, I hope you get well soon." So there was the kind of dignity and surrender that he taught. There was the willingness just to see things as they are, the kind of honesty. This is the way it is. It's suffering, isn't it? You know, do you think I'm the person that's going to heal her? Things are the way they are. And he just accepted life on its own terms from this place in the center. And then he taught that with this presence, it was with seeing clearly, with the quality of presence and surrender, that it was possible to let go. And he reminded people over and over that spiritual life is really very simple. It's not far away, and it doesn't have to do with, you know, all those people in ancient India around the Buddha, which is all just our fantasy anyway, isn't it? That if spiritual life is to be true, it to be of any value, if the Buddha meant anything, it has to be here and now. So the Eightfold Path, he said, the true Eightfold Path, usually it's taught traditionally as, you know, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right concentration, all that, but the true Eightfold Path is here within us. Two eyes, two ears, two nostrils, a tongue, and a body. These eight doors are the entire Eightfold Path. And the citta, the mind, the heart, is that which walks the path. Know these doors, examine them, and all of the Dharma of the Buddha will be revealed. Suffering and the end of suffering are to be found only here. You know, and he talked about then how you should practice. He said, you know, you're all involved in looking for the Buddha and who's a good monk and who's a bad monk. He said, watching others will never get you enlightened. Maybe if you look at others 10% of the time, what others are doing, and look at yourself 90%, that's about the right measure. We get so fixed on how it's supposed to be, and on the outer forms, and we don't look at the heart. And he was very beautiful and impeccable with the keeping of the dignity and the rules of the monastery, but he was never fixed on that. And he talked about it. He said, I had one teacher who made a lot of noises as he ate. You know, he told us to eat mindfully and carefully, and yet he was really sloppy. And here we are all eating carefully, and he's, you know, making noises and being sloppy, and he's the teacher. And I said, I watched him so much, and I suffered. I judged him so much, I suffered. He wasn't suffering. He was just enjoying his meal. I was the one that suffered. He said, some people drive fast, and they, you know, they can do it carefully. Others people drive slowly, they still have a lot of accidents. How can you know what's going on in that person? Your task is to know what's going on in yourself. So I complained to him, and this is the story, I suppose, one of the stories that's to me the most, oh, it was a very wonderful moment. Because I wanted to leave the monastery. I'd heard about the Burmese monasteries where you could sit and walk for, you know, 16 hours a day and you didn't have to chant and nobody was there asking if you were suffering or not and you didn't have to sweep the pass and the food was better and you could really get enlightened. There were all these states you could get to, you know. And so I told him that I was getting very impatient because my meditation wasn't deepening and the monastery was too distracting. We had this work to do and we had to chant and sit around and, you know, his cottage when visitors came and do all these monastic tasks and so forth. And then I began to watch, you know, you watch your teacher, and I noticed he wasn't very consistent. He'd say one thing one time and then he'd say something entirely different another time, you know. And I began to think, what kind of enlightenment is this? Or he'd sit there and he'd scratch himself. You know, and I think, wait, is he being mindful when he scratches, right? Or is he really, has he lost it, you know? And all these ideas about how an enlightened person is supposed to look. We have so many ideas, you know. And so I complained. I said to him, you know, I'm thinking of leaving, going to a Burmese monastery. He said, yeah. And I said, and I'm watching you, and I said, you're teaching about enlightenment and mindfulness, but how do I know you're enlightened? I mean, sometimes you look wise, but other times you're not very consistent. You say this, and then you, you know, do that, or you say this, and so forth, you know. And he laughed. He thought, he said, this is great. You're watching me, aren't you? I said, yeah. He said, and I don't look like the Buddha to you, do I? I said, no. Really? He said, that's really good. And I was shocked. I said, what do you mean that's good? You know? He said, because if I look like the Buddha to you, if Ajahn Chah fits your idea of the Buddha, he said, then you'll still think the Buddha's out here somewhere. You'll be caught in that, and he's not here. You're looking in the wrong place, honey. He's not out here. There's only one place you'll find the Buddha. So the meditation he taught was so simple. He talked about taking the one seat, you know, as if there's this room that you sit in, and you take a seat and you open the six windows and doors, which are the windows of the senses, and you take a seat in the center of the room, and you allow whatever wants to come in and out the doors to rise and pass as it does, and you have only one job. Stay in the seat and see what comes. He said, and that, from that place, we can learn the whole Dhamma of the heart, of all the ways we get entangled, and what it means to really find peace, to really find freedom. So simple. Meditation wasn't for him to get some states, to dissolve yourself into light, to have these great insights and visions and all of those things. You know, to meditate in that way, to get some experience, is like, okay, now I have it. Oh, I got it. It's great. I need more of this. Oh, I got it. It's so good. It's like holding your breath. Okay, I got it. Meditation, finally. You know? For him, meditation wasn't about that. It was a way to be with things as they are. It is a way to be with things as they are. And to discover that the heart can be free. So the letting go, in all these ways, letting go of our ideas of how the teacher should be, letting go of our opinions, letting go of looking for the Eightfold Path to be something out there, but seeing that it's in each moment. He offered, he encouraged people to let go in so many different ways. A kind of initiation. You know, if he noticed that it was a monk who talked all the time, at some point he would arrange for that person to be sent to a really lonely monastery where there's nobody to talk to. You know, if he noticed somebody was really into quietude and running away because the world was too difficult and they had a lot of aversion, they didn't like the ways, he would somehow arrange that you had the monastery assignment along the highway where everybody was coming to stop and, you know, you'd have to receive visitors all the time. If you were afraid of ghosts at some point, you know, he would make sure that you spent time in the forest at night. If you were bored or restless, he would say, go into it. Face it. Discover the heart's freedom in the midst of that which you have run away from. You know, I got angry at one point. I was really angry. I said, what should I do with all this anger? He said, oh, that's good. Take all your robes, go into your hut, shut the windows, shut the doors. Little tin-roofed huts at the hot season, right? Put all your robes on and be angry and sit in the middle of it and see what the anger feels like. You know, if you're going to be angry, do it right. Go and really be angry. You know? Or I was sleepy a lot in the beginning of my meditation. I still get sleepy at times a lot, but, you know, we'd be sitting up all night, and it was so hard to do. I said, what can I do? He'd say, walk backwards. I said, I still fall asleep. Walk backwards in the forest at night. Maybe that will help you, you know? I was still so sleepy. He said, all right, for you I have a cure. There's a well near your cottage, right? Go sit on the edge of the well. Right, let's see what happens. Sit, you know, you start to sleep and you have to look down. You're going to fall down into the well. You know, so the way of practice was not to run away from the world, because the world is seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching. This is the world. But to have dignity and presence and realize that you can be right in the middle of experience and know the heart of freedom. To let things go or let things be. I remember when I came back, I did leave Wat Pa Phong to go to practice in these Burmese monasteries and various other places. And I had very wonderful experiences in a way. I'd wanted to, you know, do a long retreat because I'd heard about this and, you know, get very concentrated and see if I could notice all these subtle things about the nature of the mind that you read in various texts and Buddhist psychology and so forth. And some good things of that kind happen. And I came back to Wat Ma Phong after I'd been away for a year and a half in Burmese monastery and then down at Ajahn Jamnian's and so forth, to spend some more time with Ajahn Chah. And I bowed and I sat down and he said, you're back. I said, yeah. He said, so what happened? And I told him about, oh, I had this experience and all this, you know, insight about that, and this is the retreats, and I kind of finished. I was kind of, you know, proud of myself. Hey, now I'm back. And he listened to it all. He said, oh, that's nice. And then he looked at me, he said, something else to let go of, isn't it? That was all he said about all those experiences. Something else to let go of. Because if you can't let go, you can't be free. You know, and no matter what experience you had yesterday in meditation, here we come and we see it again. If we're trying to repeat that experience, it can't be done. You can't repeat the past. It's clinging. It's suffering. Surrender, dignity, a kind of honesty about himself and the world and others, a letting go. And with it, then, there blossomed around him, or you could say maybe he rested in the great heart of the Buddha, the wisdom that is really who we are. I mean, he'd look around and he'd say, okay, you're sitting here and you're listening to all these people talk about this man you never met, right? As if, you know, that's going to help you very much. Or these teachings, you know, from far away, Thailand or something like that. But think about it. Look at the difficulty. Reflect on what's really hard in your own life. What's the place that's really your place of suffering? Because you know what it is. And then imagine in that place of suffering, suppose the Buddha were to come in, you know, to that place where you have so much conflict or fear or difficulty or loss or grief or whatever your struggle is. What would the Buddha be like even in the face of that? You can contemplate, you can imagine. Reflect on that. And you get a little sense. How would the Buddha be? Would he be uptight? How would his body feel? What would his heart be like? And then you say, well, that image that comes of the Buddha being in that place of difficulty that you have, in that big suffering, where does that Buddha come from? How are you able to know that? You know what it would feel like to meet that circumstance with real compassion. That difficulty with great compassion, to meet it with a free heart. You know what that would be like. You do. Where is that Buddha? So to live with him was this invitation to remember where the Buddha really is, to remember that which we already know, what he called Puru, the one who knows inside. You already know. We tend to judge ourselves so much. We tend to struggle so much. And to not struggle doesn't mean you can't do beautiful things in this world. You can't work to right the injustices of the world. That you can't say no to the racism and the pollution of the environment and to the suffering that you can do something about. It doesn't mean that. But to do it from a place of wisdom, to act from a place of kindness and compassion instead of contributing to the suffering of the world. As he said, we human beings are constantly in combat, at war, to escape the fact of being so limited by so many circumstances we can't control. But instead of escaping, we continue to create suffering, waging war with evil, waging war with good, waging war with what is too small or too big, waging war with what is too short or too long, right or wrong, courageously carrying on the battle. Isn't it about time to stop the battle? To rest. Not to fight, but to see this human realm as it is, from our own Buddha wisdom, from the eyes, the heart of the Buddha. And from that place, people would come and say, well, I have doubts, what should I do? And he'd say, doubts are natural. Everyone will have doubts. That's fine. See how they come and go. Look and see who is it that experiences these doubts. That's the place you want to look from. Who do these doubts arise in? How can you be free with the doubts still arising and passing? There is a freedom to be found. Or desire. I still have desires, Ajahn Chah. What should I do? He said, it's like children, isn't it? They come and they say, I want to go to Disneyland. Can we have candy? What are we going to do after lunch? Can we have this? Can we have that? He said, you know, you don't try to beat the children away when they do that. You just smile at them. Sure, sure, it's okay. They're there. That's the desiring mind. It's just what it is. It's just the way it is. The thoughts come. I'm doing it right. I'm not doing it right. They're doing it right. They're not doing it right. Oh, my meditation, it's getting so good. I'm going to get enlightened any minute. And he would laugh. He'd say, that's the moment where you lose it, isn't it? Oh, what am I going to do after I get enlightened? Ah, such a great thought. And all you do is, you see, that's the thinking mind, isn't it? We went on a drive one day. We were invited to this temple on the Cambodian border. He had a number of branch temples that began to grow. Initially, when we were first there, it was, just two or three branch temples. And then gradually they've grown to more than 100. But this was one of the first 10 or so. And the driver we had was this young man in a kind of rickety Toyota pickup. And the ride was through the mountains on this dirt road that was very twisty and you couldn't see around the curves or anything. And the guy was just a mad driver. He was driving so fast, and we said, please slow down a little bit. He didn't listen. He was this young guy who was into driving, you know. And mostly the road was empty, this dirt road. But periodically there would be logging trucks or buses, you know, or somebody on a bicycle or a water buffalo in the middle of the road or something. And you couldn't see around the curves. And he's just driving. And so I'm holding on. My knuckles are white. And I'm, you know, saying, all right, I'm going to die a monk. I better compose myself, breathing and out, kind of, because it was really alarming. And then I look over and I see Ajahn Chah's holding on, and his knuckles are white too, you know. And I think, oh, there's some kind of, you know how it is, some relief. Oh, him too. Here we are, you know. And finally we made it. We pulled in the courtyard of this little kind of primitive temple there. The car stopped. It's silent for a moment after this ride. And he looks at me and he said, scary ride, wasn't it? It's just that, with this big smile, you know, like he'd just been to Disneyland and had the e-ticket ride, right? And there's a way in which I don't think he was afraid to die, really. He showed it in so many fashions. So I don't think that's what was going on when he was holding on in the car. It was just the way it was. It was a scary ride. And he looked and said, scary ride, isn't it? As if you could bow to it and say, that's the scary ride. That's that part of life. It's just the way things are. And with him, one then sensed this letting go, this peace, and with a tremendous kind of compassion. The compassion that came because he didn't want anything from anybody. People came to him, you know, in every circumstance. He wasn't asking for anything. He was just there. He could smile. He'd just be where he was. He said, we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. This is the heritage of every being, every Buddha that appears in the world. But what is the Buddha? When we see with the eye of wisdom, we know that the Buddha is timeless, unborn, unrelated to any body or history or statue. I mean, it's kind of amazing to walk in and see this whole little, it's like the inflated Buddha was put up here in this whole artificial forest, and here we are in this big kind of temple. It's beautiful to see. But he said the real Buddha is none of those things. Buddha is the ground of all being. He talked about it as Jit Dham, the original mind, the realization of truth of the unmoving mind. So the Buddha was not enlightened in India. In fact, he was never enlightened. He was never born and never died. And this timeless awakened one is our true home, our abiding place. When we take refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, in the way things are, in the Sangha, all things in the world are free for us. They become our teacher, proclaiming the one true nature of life. Sometimes we're fortunate and blessed, as I was, to meet somebody who changes your life. He changed my life. And all the study and teachings and practices and things that I've done since then, I feel like in my own life, they kind of rest on the ground of this experience of being with this man. Because he rested on the ground. He just was where he was. And it was so beautiful in those moments when you remembered, when I wasn't struggling and, you know, unhappy and imagining and things, but when my eyes would open, when you could listen to the music, when you heard, oh, you know, that's Miles Davis, that's Coltrane playing the very best, and you go, wow, listen to that. In those moments, it was like, oh, here's somebody who really shows what it's possible for us as human beings to live in this body, your body, with this mind on this earth, and be really happy and free. Try to be mindful. Let things take their natural course. Then the mind, the heart, will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at the pool. You'll clearly see the nature of all things. You'll see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. Thank you.